Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Larry was just miserable there, and he almost came to blows with Dick Ebersol. I forget what, I'm sure it had to do with a sketch. I think Dick told him that something he'd written wasn't funny, and Larry went berserk. There was a lot of tension on that floor, and people were always sort of threatening each other. Brad got mad once, too. He went crazy. That's one of the reasons I liked Larry so much, because he lost his temper. Somebody threw a chair through a wall, too. I think that was Jim Belushi.
Larry David. I did meet Julia there. Yes, I did. And obviously that had some impact. I didn't really write for her then. I didn't really write for anyone in particular. I would cast after I wrote. But I remember thinking that she was terrific and underused.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus. I did a couple of things that for some reason are still played in gay bars around the country, like Spit Take Talk Show. A bunch of my friends who've been in gay bars say they've seen that played a lot. Mary and I once did a parody of The Rink, a Broadway show with Liza Minnelli. Our parody was called The Womb, and it's also playing in gay bars. I have no idea why. I guess it has a certain campiness to it.
Brad Hall. It was particularly frustrating as a writer. We'd have these massive read-throughs of 30 sketches or something, that everybody had just sort of vomited up all these sketches with no real focus as to what the show was going to be about that week. And there was a lot of news going on, Reagan era. There was stuff we could have been parodying. I don't think Ebersol wanted that, and I don't think NBC did. Someone's taste did not run towards satire, and so the very thing that originally made the show popular was really resisted. We had people that could do good impressions of all the right people. You look back, it's kind of bizarre. The election in 1984, there's almost no political humor during an entire political election. Nothing. And for me, doing the news, it was really frustrating. My brilliant idea was that I should have been a real news guy. I should have gone out and covered real news stories from the SNL perspective. That's what I wanted to do. But they were much more keen on doing, President Reagan had his hand stuck to his head today, and show a picture.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus. It wasn't a particularly happy experience for me. To begin with, I will take responsibility for some of it, because I was extremely young. I hadn't graduated college, and I was very naive about how things work in real show business, so I went into it very green. I had been in their audience. I was a teenager when the show was sort of at its height. So then to be plucked out of Chicago between my junior and senior year of college to go on the show was head-spinning, to say the very least. I thought it was going to be a congenial experience. My head was in the clouds. I wasn't aware of the politicking one had to do, and I think there were a lot of drugs going on at the time, but I was unaware of that as well, to tell you the truth. I was always surprised at read-through, though, when certain writers' sketches were 18 pages long and they were laughing and laughing, and I was so confused as to how they could possibly have found it so funny and made it so long. Everybody was doing a lot of coke and smoking dope. Everybody would stay up late. All the work was done between 11 o'clock at night and 6 o'clock in the morning. That's when everybody was functioning. And that wasn't, in my view, conducive to comedy. Doing Seinfeld was, of course, just the opposite experience. It was pure joy from beginning to end. I thought, no one will ever get this, because we're having too much fun. Margaret Obermann. There are certain people who really go after Saturday Night Live because of that boys' club business. I think that element certainly existed, but I think it was like anything else. You had to be a survivor to make that show work for you, and that was true of men and women. There was a certain political kind of thing that went on there, and you had to know that and function within those rules. And if you didn't know that, then maybe you weren't as happy as some other people were.
Elliot Wald. Herb Sargent said at the end of one season, "Our biggest fuck-up this year is we did not find stuff for Julia to do. She is really talented." A lot of people didn't see that, but the fact is Herb was right, and we were wrong. Not that I thought she wasn't talented, but I thought she was limited and hard to write for. It was my own inability to write for her, and obviously not any lack of talent on her part. That was the problem.
Margaret Obermann. Julia is one of those people who doesn't like to talk about the show. It's my opinion that she shouldn't be so negative about it. I love Julia, but I just feel like that show really helped her. It got her out there, and she met Larry David. So how bad could it have been? It complicated things for her that Brad Hall, her boyfriend, who joined the show when she didn't stay the full time with the show, and there was a lot of acrimony. He was very, very unhappy, so that complicated things for her. But I just feel like she'd be better off not saying how horrible she thought it was. I don't know what she's going to gain from that. She's had so many great things happen to her. Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Dick Ebersol was always wielding a baseball bat. He would always hold this bat when he would have these meetings. The writers and the actors would be there, and he would have the bat in hand. It was really very Al Capone, and he always wanted me to straighten my hair. He was always trying to get me to straighten my hair. Well, he's in sports now.
Andrew Kurtzman. To this day, I miss working live. There is nothing quite like that. There was a sketch we did in which Chris Guest dropped his script. He was doing a voiceover from the announcer's booth, but he dropped the script and couldn't retrieve it right away. And so we just went dark for a while. We stayed on a title card or something, and Chris was pawing around the bottom of the booth, looking for this lost piece of script, and unaware that he was being cued. He'd just dropped it, and to reach it, he had to take off his headphones and thus missed his cue. So we just stopped TV for a while. It's like stopping time. Andy Breckman. I mostly wrote for the B-cast, like Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Gary Kroger, and my sketches were usually on at 12:50. That used to be the time for high-concept stuff, the writer's sketches. Martin Short. If you're just a performer, you were at the mercy of what they would hand you. You had more control of your fate as a writer-performer. If you were just an actor on the show, it was not as gratifying as if you were an actor-writer. I love that control, you know, making it actually funny. Other people did write for me. Jim Downey was there that year, and Andy Breckman, two strong writers. But there was a tendency to write for yourself, particularly if you were perceived as someone who did strange material. People would sometimes feel like they wouldn't know how to write for that. I must admit, when the live stuff would work, there was a great excitement that you could never capture anywhere else. Dick Ebersol. Billy and Chris and Marty and Harry, for that matter, were writers, and they were a pleasure. Billy's contribution on the writing side was so enormous. He was writing 2, 3, some weeks 4 pieces a show. In the history of the show up to that point, only Chevy in the first 2 or 3 months was ever that prolific. Billy Crystal. I think maybe in a way we represented the age group that stayed with the show from beginning to end. We were, 9 years later. The audience that started with the show was now 37, 38 also. So we hit a big chord with those people, and that was good. Some of our pieces were really funny and inventive. And you had people who could play characters and do voices. Marty and I did Kate and Ali, where I played Muhammad Ali and he played Katharine Hepburn. And bringing Grimley and bringing Fernando and finding I Hate When That Happens, which is something Chris Guest and I used to do as friends, and that being a big hit, was another part of the success of the show. Jim Belushi. Ebersol fired me the first week of December in my second season. I wasn't on the Christmas show. I begged for my job back, and I came back in January. Why did he fire me? Because I was uncontrollable, throwing things down halls and angry and disruptive. I might have been an asshole, really, because of my own frustration and being in the middle child syndrome. Then he let me back, and I stopped drinking because every time I'd gotten upset, I went down to Hurley's bar and shot some whiskey. So then you have behavior you're not proud of. I don't regret any of it, though. I've taken all those experiences and learned from them. I got more serious about my work and my craft after that. So in a way, I thank him. It was the best firing that ever happened to me. Hosting had become a hip, chic thing to do in the first years of Saturday Night Live, and the list of hosts was audacious and eclectic. During the Dumanian and early Ebersol years, that gig lost luster. But with the rise of Eddie Murphy, and then the year that starred Billy Crystal and Martin Short, hosting status rose again. Brandon Tartikoff, the seemingly ever youthful NBC programmer who survived the Fred Silverman regime and went on to success and acclaim under Grant Tinker, felt protective and brotherly towards Saturday Night Live, even though at least once during his reign he actually canceled it, then about 24 hours later gave it a reprieve. He believed SNL was one of the network's signature shows, and that to kill it would be almost sacrilegious. When in New York, and not at his office in Burbank, Tartikoff liked to drop by the 8th-floor studios and 17th-floor offices of the show. And a dream of his came true when his old friend Ebersol invited him to host. Tartikoff was involved in his own far more dramatic and consequential life-and-death struggle, having been diagnosed years earlier with Hodgkin's disease. Through it all, he showed an unflappable resiliency. He hosted right after an exhausting round of chemotherapy, wearing a toupee to hide the attendant hair loss. Dick Ebersol. It was late 1982, and Brandon was clearly back into serious problems with cancer. And at that point, Grant knew, Lily knew, and I knew, and maybe one or two other personal friends and his parents knew. And that was it. And so he starts heavily into chemo, and actually, when his daughter Calla was born in November of 82, Lily delivered Calla and then went, not that many hours after, to another part of the same hospital to hold Brandon's hand while he had a chemo treatment. Lily said to me, "He's really pulling this off, or he thinks he is, but I know deep down inside that he's kind of down." And I got the idea at the time to put something in front of him. I called her 2 weeks later and said, "I have an idea. Brandon's the ultimate ham. How about if I give him the ultimate moment? I'll offer him hosting the season premiere of Saturday Night Live, and he'll have 5 or 6 months to look forward to that if he successfully completes his chemo at the end of the spring." And that's how he ended up hosting that show. It was really initially done to give him something to look forward to as he went through the chemo. And, you know, for those next 6 months, all I got from him were ideas about, "I'll do this, I'll do that."
Lily Tartikoff. When they asked him to host, he literally had just finished chemo. If you look at the footage of Brandon, he is totally moon-faced. The steroids were still very much in his system. And at the time they asked him to host, he didn't have a hair on his head. And yet you have no idea how thrilling it was for him. I don't think he ever anticipated that anybody would ever ask him to host Saturday Night Live. But that was one of the great moments of his career that literally has nothing to do with his career. I had to remind him that that was not what he was supposed to be doing. In fact, when he said he would do it, I was furious because I thought, how much pressure can you put on yourself and on me? I took everything personally. I tried to talk sense into him, you know. I just said, "You're not Steve Martin. You're Brandon Tartikoff. You're supposed to, like, wear a suit and run the network. Who do you think you are? What makes you think that they're going to roll out that carpet and you're going to know what to do?" But really, there was no way I was going to get in the way of that. I think Brandon would have given up his day job to work on Saturday Night Live if they had ever asked. I think it symbolized every reason for him forever being at a network and being able to put on a show, a Saturday Night Live. He was completely attached to it and loyal, and he wouldn't, and couldn't, give it up. It was a place all unto its own for him. He would leave the network before he would sever those ties or end that show. Brandon said that when he did the dress rehearsal, he was really relaxed. But when they said, "Live from New York, it's Saturday night," he said he had never been that frightened in his life. And normally nothing scared Brandon. This is a man who had just survived 9 rounds of chemotherapy. Margaret Obermann. Jerry Lewis hosted the show when I was there. That was a total trip. It was so out there, so insane. We had one writer who was just out of Harvard. He was 21, and Jerry Lewis literally said to him, "I've got ties older than you." He was just such an odd guy. It was his second marriage to a woman he's still married to. I remember so vividly him taking the gum out of his mouth and her holding her hand out and him putting the gum in her hand. He told me some outrageously foul story about how he'd just done Hell's a Poppin' with Lynn Redgrave, and somebody asked him what he thought of Lynn Redgrave, and he'd said, "I'd like to take my cock out and piss all over her." It was just insane.
Tim Kazurinsky. One little test I used to do was on a Monday morning when we'd meet the host. I would ask the host if he would be interested in doing a sketch called The William Holden Drinking Helmet. I would always gauge by their reaction, because poor Bill Holden had fallen and cracked his head open and bled to death. So I always thought, if they laughed at that at least, I knew it would be a good week. And if they went, "What? Oh, no, that's sick," then I thought, "Uh-oh, we're dicked." That was my little running gag to see if they had a sense of humor or if they were going to be a dickhead like Robert Blake. David Sheffield. My vote for worst host is Robert Blake. He was sitting in a room and a sketch was handed to him by Gary Kroger, who was a writer-actor, a sketch called Breezy Philosopher, a one-premise sketch about a lofty teacher who's kind of a biker tough guy, talking about Kierkegaard. Students kept asking questions while he combed his hair, and he'd say, "Hey, I don't know." Blake sat there and read that with his glasses down his nose, then wadded it up, turned to Kroger, and said, "I hope you got a tough asshole, pal, because you're going to have to wipe your ass with that one." And he threw it and bounced it off Gary's face. Martin Short. Jack Palance was on once, and no one laughed at the sketch, and it was so strange. Jim Downey wrote it, it was just the strangest scene, and it got cut at dress. I remember that some of those scenes that didn't make it to air are just kind of classically funny to me in their way. The scene was something like, "What would you do if I told you Jack Palance was standing behind that door?" That was it, and then he would come out. And it died at dress. I remember I said, "Isn't there an applause sign someone could have turned on or something?" And Billy Crystal said, "They were flashing the applause sign. The audience still wouldn't clap." To me, Ed Grimley's most memorable encounter was with Jesse Jackson, two people you just don't expect to see in the same sketch, when Jesse hosted the show. We were supposed to be sitting next to each other on an airplane. They kept saying, "Now, when you climb over Jesse, you mustn't actually fall on him," although it was in the script. I never did fall on him at rehearsal. I just did it for the live show. They didn't want me to do anything that made him look silly or foolish. But he was terrific about it. He was great. He loved it. Dick Ebersol. About 8 shows into that season, just before Christmas of 84, we did a show which Ringo Starr came to host, and everybody was exhausted. I think it was the 2nd of 3 in a row or something, but everybody was just worn out. And the Wednesday night read-through was a travesty. And I took Ringo and Barbara Bach, his wife, and walked, as you can from NBC, almost underground all the way back to the Berkshire Hotel over on East 52nd Street, and kept saying, "Don't worry," to them, which you often tell a host. Lorne used to say, maybe he still does, you're basically bluffing the host from Monday till Friday. In this case, I leveled with Ringo. I said, what you saw today won't be the show. And I went back with Billy and Chris and about 10 people on the writing staff. I think this may be the only time it happened in the history of the show. I said, we have nothing, I know everybody is exhausted, but let's take all of our best characters and let's write a show around them. And let's break the rule that you go 3 or 4 shows between great characters. Whether it be Fernando at that point with Billy, or whether it was Marty doing Grimley, I said, everything's fair game. We just have to show this guy a great show. We've got nothing now. And that night, with no sleep for 2 days, each one of them wrote a piece, and it turned out to be a pretty good show. I offer all that as evidence of the fact that here you have mature adult stars, as they were in the world of comedy, all of them, and they easily accepted, with no complaint, starting completely from scratch that late in the week, which up to that point never happened in the history of the show. They were pros. Martin Short. When Ringo hosted, that was exciting. I remember my wife coming in on a Friday, and when she saw Ringo, she got so flustered she was shaking. I said, I can't believe you're shaking. And she said, that is a beetle. She was totally overwhelmed. That part of Saturday Night Live was always the most fun, meeting the celebrities and going to the parties. Andrew Kurtzman. Sid Caesar came in and was absolutely stunned at the way we did things, and I was given the task of working with Sid. He had a rather elaborate parody of, I think it was Tootsie and Rocky combined. I wasn't quite hip enough to know I was writing the vanity piece that wouldn't get on the air, because I knew your show of shows, and I guess Sid kind of locked on to me. They made me Sid's boy for the week. He took me to a dinner at some hotel, not the Algonquin, but one of these faded glory places where they knew him when he was the TV god of the 50s. The carpet was getting a little tatty, but they still had the overpriced Italian dining room. And he ate the strangest meal I've ever seen. Sid claimed to eat one meal a day. He starts with a veal chop as big as a baby's head. The thing is oozing cheese, and he eats his and then eats half of mine because I couldn't get near it. He eats both our portions of spaghetti. As we're gasping after all this food, he says, wait, they do me a special dessert. You won't like it. It's just for me. It's this health thing. They bring to the table a salad bowl, a large-sized box of shredded wheat, the ones where the biscuits are the size of Brillo pads, and it's a full box, not your little individual serving packs. Then comes a 32-ounce container of yogurt, an enormous bowl of berries, and an equally large bowl of raisins and nuts. I would say there were probably 4 pounds of food there. And he proceeds to combine this into a mash in the big salad bowl, and then drops it on top of this Italian pasta we'd just been eating. It was the strangest thing I'd ever seen. And all the time he's talking about the sketch we were going to do, a sketch that never got on the air. What astonished Sid, what he could not believe, is that we wrote 30 sketches to get 9. He was absolutely baffled by that, because that's not the way they did it in his day. He said all of these things should be one line in a meeting. You kill it right there or you decide it's perfect. It's the right thing, and then you go work on it until it's great. He just didn't agree with the system. I don't know if it was Lauren's invention or what. Dick Ebersaw. I met Susan St. James when she came to host the show that was the second show of the next full season. At midnight, the writers went on strike, and we couldn't go back on the air. She was pushing the movie Carbon Copy. She does the show on Saturday, and 5 weeks after that show, we were married.
Robin Schlynn. This is a very Dick story. When Susan St. James hosted the show, that's how they met. I guess it was immediate attraction, and he ended up with her at Xenon, a big disco back then. And they were like making out at Xenon, and someone from some paper caught them, and it was in the paper the next day. Now, most people would be embarrassed about this, right? Dick put the clipping up on the wall of his office.
David Sheffield. Favorite hosts included Stevie Wonder, who was a terrific host. It was an interesting week because cue cards were right out. He had a little earpiece, and someone was feeding the lines to him off camera, his brother. He was just a great host. There was one host who came on. He was drunk and senile. He kept going, "Where's Gilda? When's Gilda showing up?" He was so arrogant. He basically just did a monologue. Donald Pleasance. Dick Ebersol. The first three shows of the 82-83 season, the first show was hosted by nobody. That was the one where Jimmy Kahn's sister had bone marrow cancer and he pulled out. So we did the show with no host. And Rod Stewart was the musical guest. And Tina Turner was in New York, and I suggested to whoever was managing Rod at the time, why don't they get together? And they had a memorable duet. With John Madden, it was really about the closest I ever came to having a heart attack before I had a real one in February of 96. In the last half hour of Dress, John had, in effect, a second monologue. And basically, it was bringing him out to tell some stories that he told normally about various crazy football players who had played for him on the Raiders. But it was so funny, we had helped him shape it into like a 2 or 3 minute monologue about 1 hour and 10 minutes into the show. So we were in a break, and John was up on home base to do the second monologue when he said, in a booming voice, "Ebersol! Ebersol!" And I'm under the bleachers in approximately the same area that Lorne works at today. I stuck my head around the corner so he could see me. He said, "Come here a minute." I came to about halfway to the stage area with a full house, whatever it is, 300+ for Dress, and he said, "I just want to tell you now, I'm going to finish this dress rehearsal, and then I'm going to leave. I'm not happy with how things have been going, and I'm enough of a trooper to finish it for this audience, but then I'm out of here. This is just the pits." I'm standing there, and I'm dying. And he lets about 2 or 3 seconds go, and then he gets the biggest smile on his face in the world, and he said, "You know I'm a practical joker, don't you?" The place went nuts. But in the meantime, I had just about had a heart attack. Andy Breckman. When Sam Kinison hosted, I don't think I've ever laughed harder. He did a little bit of his act for the staff about necrophilia. There was an article in the paper about a guy who was caught having sex with a dead guy in a funeral home. The question was whether Sam could do the joke on the show. It was in the air all week whether or not it was something he would be allowed to do. And I guess they eventually decided he couldn't. Danny DeVito, host. The first time I did it was when Taxi had just gotten a bunch of Emmys and then they promptly canceled the show. And we did a whole thing on Saturday Night Live where we blew up the ABC building in the cold opening and the taxi drove off the bridge. The weird thing is that the show goes by so quick when you do it. They pull you from one spot to the next. You're putting a wig on or a mustache and going, "Oh, this is the skit we're doing. Oh, I remember. This is what we're doing." They're in tune to it. They lead you around by the nose, basically. And it's over before it seems like you started it. You have to go with the flow. And you can't sit there and think about it too much. You have to just accept a lot of things in trust and go for it.
Margaret Obermann. There were scenes. There were definitely scenes. One was particularly nasty. It involved Michael Keaton, who was a friend of mine who would come to do the show, and who was very hot off night shift. And between the Monday when Michael came in and the read-through, Dick decided he didn't like him, and brought in Michael Palin, who was a real friend of the show and would come in occasionally to do things, and who everybody loved. And Dick sort of inched Keaton out and moved Palin in. And it was pretty nasty. Keaton was really hurt and angry, and never really understood it. It was aberrant behavior on Dick's part. Keaton was one of those guys who, as an actor in read-through, was very laid back, and wouldn't really give you too much, and Dick was convinced he was just bad, and just lost all confidence in him. Palin didn't know what was going on. He was oblivious. It was really awkward. One of those yucky, strange things that leaves a really bad taste in your mouth.
Harry Shearer. I had been writing this series of Reagan sketches called Hellcats in the White House, none of which got on the air. And the last one, they had me in Reagan makeup from dress straight through air. So I spent 8 straight hours in Reagan makeup, and I think Bob Tischler finally told me at 12:53 the sketch was cut. And I said to him, I kind of figured that out. So for 3 straight weeks I wasn't on the air, and I just at that point decided I had better things to do with my time. I'm not the tantrum type, although I think I'm better at hiding my feelings than I am. I'm told that when I'm unhappy in a situation, people know it just by the cloud that gathers over me. So on January 13th at 1:43 a.m., Dick said, "You know, we should stop this." And I said, "Well, I do too, but I think you have to pay me for the rest of the year." He said, "Okay," and then I left. I had said to Bob Tischler early on, "Why is Billy Crystal getting all this exposure on the show?" And he said, "Billy's stuff is more commercial than yours." And I said, "But this is a late-night show. Why is that the calculation?" When I left, Dick issued a press release saying, "Creative differences." And the first person who called me for a comment on it read that to me, and I blurted out, "Yeah, I was creative and they were different." Dick Ebersol. There weren't many ego problems to deal with there, none at all, other than with Harry Shearer, who just got out of control. So by the end of January, I let him go. I had talked to each cast member before I did, and for the most part they were okay with it. A couple of them, who should go nameless, were sad, but they had to admit that the problem had gotten out of hand. Martin Short. Harry wanted to be creative, and Dick wanted something else. Harry's very smart and very prolific, and I think that he felt his voice should be represented on the show. When he wouldn't get a chance, it made him very upset. If someone had said, "Harry, here's 8 minutes of show, do whatever you want, and the rest of the show will be what it is," I think he felt there was an audience out there that would be interested to hear what he had to say. So that was a source of huge frustration between the two of them. James Downey. I used to walk down the street with Bill Murray and have to stand there patiently for 20 minutes of, like, drooling and ass-kissing by people who would come up to him. And Murray would point to me and say, "Well, he's the guy who writes all the stuff." But they would continue to ooh and ah over him. Murray can be a real asshole, but the thing that keeps bringing me back to defend him is I've seen him be an asshole to people who could affect his career way more often than to people who couldn't. Harry Shearer will shit on you to the precise degree that it's cost-free. He's a total ass-kisser with important people. Back when neither of us was making much money, Murray and I would take these cheap flights to Hawaii. We had to stop in Chicago, and at the airport there'd be these baggage handlers just screaming at the sight of him. And he would take enormous amounts of time with them, and even get into, like, riffs with them. I enjoyed it, because it was really entertaining. We went down to see Audrey Pert Dickman once, and the toll guy on the Jersey Turnpike looked in and recognized Murray and went crazy. We stopped, and people were honking, and Bill was doing autographs for the guy and his family. I've yet to meet the celebrity who was universally nice to everyone, but the best at it is Murray. Even to people who had nothing to do with his career or the business. Tim Kazurinsky. It got really, really depressing, and there was also the notion, I think from Ebersol, from Yale Business School or wherever the freak he came from, of divide and conquer. I was like tops of the group. I was the old guy that people would come to for life advice and medical questions. I was mom and pop. And I noticed that Ebersol would keep the cast off balance. He would try and keep it divisive and pit people against each other, because if we were united, if we were unionized, he was fucked. And he always did everything he could to keep the cast from being cohesive. I remember my last year there, they offered me Weekend Update about 3/4 of the way through the season. And I said, "That's really fucked. Brad Hall would feel horrible. I mean, that's just like yanking him in the middle of the season." Everybody's ego was fucked up enough. If you're going to do something like that, do it at the end of the season. And I just said no. I didn't have the stomach for it. Brian Doyle Murray. I got along with Ebersol. He was kind of goofy, but he's basically a likable guy.
Margaret Obermann. I think Dick was made fun of by Lorne. They used to call him Patches. He was the NBC guy, kind of a suit. But I think that in a funny way he knew what he was doing. Look what he did. It was trial and error. He didn't pretend to be a creative genius, and he did some really low-rent things. It was not at that time a very hip show to be on in a certain way. The first year I was there, the hosts were like, we used to call them the Bobs, Robert Culp, Robert Conrad. It was such a weird array of people. But, you know, Dick kept it afloat, and all these people came out of it, and there were some great moments. It wasn't consistently wonderful, but then I don't know if it was ever consistently wonderful since the original show, and even that wasn't consistent. But the level of talent was so high, you just didn't care.
Elliot Wald. I was always one of those people who stayed up late and loved to watch the sun coming up. By the time I left Saturday Night Live, I was phobic about watching the sunrise. I couldn't stand to watch it getting light because it meant time was running out and the pressure was on. So that changed my life. From a distance, they were wonderful years, and it was a good experience. But the closer in I focus, the more I remember exhaustion, disappointment, and pressure. The individual days of those years were so hard. Those 4 years took about 10 years off my life. Just the number of hours, the amount of pressure. The fact is that it's enormous pressure to be funny. And beyond that, it's enormous pressure to be funny at a particular time. You're funny on Monday and Tuesday. Being funny on Thursday just isn't the same thing. So you've got from noon Monday till read-through on Wednesday. James Downey. That last season, Dick had, when Eddie Murphy had left, he had Billy Crystal, Martin Short, Chris Guest. That was one of the best years of the show ever. They did some really wonderful original stuff. A lot of it sort of broke up the form of the show. A lot of it was on film and really had nothing to do with live. But it was really good stuff. Martin Short. SCTV was different. I did it for longer, and it was in my hometown, and it was the first show of that kind that I did, so there's obviously a special place in my heart. But I have a great fondness for Saturday Night Live and that year. I think of it as more like an event than a working job. It was like putting out a paper or something.
Margaret Obermann. At one point I was asked to write for SCTV, and I was pissed off at Dick about something, so I thought I'd go to Toronto and do that. I knew a lot of those people at SCTV, but once I went and thought hard and long about taking that job, I decided not to, and went back to Saturday Night. Because Saturday Night was really a writer's show, and SCTV was really a performer's show, and there was a big difference. As a writer, it was a better place to be. For 5 years, Saturday Night Live had gone through highs and lows, sometimes seeming like the distressed damsel in a silent movie serial, tied to railroad tracks, and then being plucked up just before the train roared through. But what had Ebersol and his stars saved? The show, or merely the title? Glorious tradition or mere commercial franchise? To some of the purists present at the creation of the precedent-shattering show, it seemed to have strayed far from its original mission and looked like it couldn't shatter a precedent with a pickaxe. And yet anything that lasts has to change, and Ebersol's final year, the one that starred Billy Crystal and Martin Short, is widely considered one of the funniest in the history of the show. The laughs were there, if not the heart.
Billy Crystal. Here's a story I never really told before. I got a movie out of my year on Saturday Night Live with Gregory Hines called Running Scared. But right before that was to start, Brandon Tartikoff called me and asked me would I consider becoming the permanent host of the show. At this point, I was in California, the night before the screen test for the movie, which was a formality because I knew I'd gotten the part, but the studio wanted to see me on film. It was actually a test to see if I could be convincing throwing a punch, which is most of what I ended up doing in the test. I was staying at Rob Reiner's house, because I had rented my house out. People were still living in it. I felt weird. I came home and couldn't go home. Brandon calls me at Rob's and says, "Listen, this is what I'm thinking about. Would you be interested?" This is May or June, right after the season had ended. I said, "Of course I'd be interested, but let me know, because then I won't test for the movie. I'll turn the movie down, because I'll have to come right back to New York and start planning." Clearly, I could not possibly do both the movie and the show. And he said, "Let me call you back." And I was ecstatic, because I felt I was ready for it. I can't describe enough how comfortable I was on that show. And then we didn't get a call. And what had happened was, this is all within 24 hours, Dick Ebersol decided not to come back. Lorne decided to come back. And not only was I not going to get what Brandon was envisioning, I was also not going to be a part of the show. Lorne wanted to start fresh and start with a whole new group of people. So the decision was sort of made for me. I would have come back. I would have liked that to happen. I've loved my career since then, but that would have been an interesting time if that had worked out. It may not have been the right thing. It may be that the show is great because it has guest hosts. Even 30 years later, it's still fun to watch people do things you wouldn't expect them to do. I look at my year on Saturday Night Live fondly as my favorite year in my career. It was an exhausting, euphoric, creative, explosive kind of feeling working with Marty, Chris, and Harry. And all of this on a show I started out to be on back in 1975 and then got bumped from the first show as a guest comedian because of time. To come back and have this show set my career in motion, even though I always wanted it to be 9 years earlier, was a great personal satisfaction. Andrew Smith. Lorne rules the reruns now. Any clips or anything like that, it's as if the Ebersol years didn't exist. Once in a while he'll throw in an Eddie Murphy, but whenever there's a clip show, it's like those years of Ebersol's just disappear. It's as if Lorne still has some kind of hard-on about Dick.